From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And, of course, along with your calls, some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Yes. Can you inherit trauma? Is it possible genetically to inherit characteristics of your parents or grandparents when it comes to psychological characteristics?
Very interesting.
Very interesting data here about evidence that has to do with trauma and evidence from a Dutch study that had to do with famine after World War II. And then we're going to talk about salt and heart failure, a very low-salt diet. We're talking about an exceptionally low-salt diet that doctors often give for heart failure. Cardiologist, is there really evidence? Does it work? I'm going to give you some new evidence that may help you decide what you are going to do.
Mm-hmm. And our recipe.
Carrot, smoked salmon, and avocado salad. Simple, easy, wonderful, tasty, fresh food. I think, Tom, you would love it. You like carrots, don't you?
Yes.
Do you like smoked salmon? Do you like lox?
Yes.
Yes. And do you like avocados?
Moving,
except for the avocados. But those of us who love avocados, I love avocados. You know, the per capita consumption of avocados has gone up sevenfold since I was in college. Sevenfold. That means you are in the minority, Tom.
In a lot of other ways, too.
In a lot of other ways.
800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. To the phones now, Zorba, welcoming our first caller, a listener in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I went to lunch with a friend last week, and after we finished eating, she pulls out a baggie full of mustard packets and then starts sucking them down.
Wait a minute. I'm just trying to picture. Did she get the mustard all over her face, too, or did she?
She's been practicing this for a while, so she was quite grateful.
Well, how many packets did she have?
I didn't count. It was a little hard to watch.
So after she did that, I assumed you questioned her.
Well, she might have seen me watching her. She said that it helped her leg cramps. She was getting a leg cramp.
Oh, uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And I am believing it's the vinegar that helps her, but I didn't want to suggest drinking vinegar to an 80-plus-year-old woman without checking it out.
Who would carry around. I can just picture like a Heinz vinegar bottle you just carry in your purse and you just chug it.
Yes.
And then you would smell like Easter eggs. Yeah. Vinegar always reminds
me.
So she's been doing this for a while?
Oh, I'm thinking maybe months. She's on a journey of health food and, you know, natural medicines that started a couple months ago.
How are her leg cramps?
She believes that it takes care of the cramps.
Uh-huh. Well, think is very important when it comes to medicine. In all seriousness, it's very important. And I want to give a very interesting thing that has to do with opioids, nothing to do with mustard, but I think hits at home. And I always ask, when I tell a story about a patient, I always ask patients, can I share this story? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
She used to be the librarian in town, bright, intelligent. She loved words. She has since passed away, neck pain. It's something called a Dowager's hump. She was bent over. Mm. And she was on one hydrocodone in the morning, one in the evening for about 20 years. And it helped her pain. So as to say. But because we have different rules now in the state of Wisconsin, once a year we have to do a drug test, make sure she's taking her drugs, see if it's in her system, make sure she's not using illegal drugs like cocaine and heroin. Okay, and so I told her, I said, we're going to do that at the next visit because I can tell them or I can spring it on them. But I wanted her to know that she shouldn't pee before she comes into the office. We're going to need a urine. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so came in the office the next month or 3 months later, and I said, we'll have to take a urine. And she said, oh, I stopped taking the drug. I said, why? She said, you know, I figured if you're going to be doing these tests and everything, I should just stop it. I said, well, how is your pain? She'd been on this for 20 years, and she said, it's about the same. And I said, oh, it's interesting. And then she asked the most interesting question. She said, have I been on a placebo? She knew the definition of placebo. Placebo comes from root to please. Mm-hmm. No, she was not on a placebo from a drug point of view. She had hydrocodone. It was not a placebo tablet. But from a point of view of to please, it made no difference. In other words, she had been on this for a long time and thought that she needed this in order to take care of her pain. And then when things changed, she decided she didn't. Her pain was unchanged. Do not disturb this woman's belief that mustard helps her leg cramps. You did exactly the right thing. Does it help her leg cramps? Sure it does. She doesn't have leg cramps anymore. That's all. Now, for Christmas or New Year's or her birthdays, you may just want to go to Amazon.com and buy her a whole box of mustard packets so she can have mustard wherever she goes. But hey, it's a folk remedy that works. Stick with it. Her leg cramps are okay. No harm, no foul.
Well, there you go. I am so glad I called. Thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing. And don't forget that gift to your friends. Send her a box of mustard packets.
Thanks so much. That number again is 800-462-7413.
I wonder if she has it like three or four times a day, like after she's having her cereal in the morning. I wonder if she downs some mustard packets. But you know something? This is where mind is so important because it helps you get through whatever maladies you have.
I don't think I'd want to have it right after cereal.
I don't think so. Then again, you don't have bad leg cramps, do you?
No.
No.
1-800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, before our next call, can we really inherit trauma?
Well, so it's an interesting thing, and there are a couple of studies. This new study out of California about essentially children, rather grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren of Civil War prisoners fits into another study. So they looked at Civil War prisoners who were in Civil War camps, appeared to be abused by today's standards. You can just imagine what those camps were. Actually, they're probably beyond our imagination and rough they were. Got out of the camps. Okay. They then had children. Okay. And then those children had children and those children had children and so on and so on. So you're looking at three and four generations down. Mm-hmm. And then they compared them with Civil War guys who were fought in the Civil War who never went into Civil War camps. And they found that the Civil War prisoners who were abused, the grandchildren or the great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren, had a higher death rate, about 10% higher death rate in any particular time in their life. The 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds, and 70-year-olds were more likely to die than the great-grandchildren of Civil War prisoners who were not abused. Now, it may be what we call an epigenetic phenomenon. In other words, maybe certain genes are activated that are passed down. What's interesting is there's a Dutch study that is very similar to this. So at the end of World War II, Holland was in starvation. And it was in starvation so bad towards the end of the war that the Germans, even while they were losing the war, said, we will not shoot down American planes who are dropping food into Holland. Holland was starving. So they looked at the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of those people who are starving, and they found that, lo and behold, they're much more likely to be a diabetic, much more likely to retain their calories. Picture, you're starving. You want to retain every calorie you have, but two or three generations out, you don't need to do it. Those grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren are more likely to be obese, more likely to be diabetic. So the question is, do we pass genes, traumatic genes, onto our children?
It's pretty interesting.
Now, is it a learned trauma that we pass on with learning? In other words, I'm traumatic. My father grew up during the Depression. So when he died, he had money in eight different bank accounts around the city. Not a lot of money, eight different bank accounts. His sister had $10,000 hidden under the sink just in cash, just in case of an emergency. Well, they didn't pass their behavior down to me. I don't have $10,000 under my sink. But on the other hand, it may be that certain traumas are passed down either through behavior or through genetics. And that's what we don't understand. I'll tell you one thing, though. Yeah. This is very important for people who have been traumatized, especially if they've been traumatized by abuse as a child. In other words, can they pass that behavioral trauma onto their grandchildren or great-grandchildren or great-great-grandchildren? Yeah. Is there something turned on in the genes? In other words, is it not just the narrative story behavior, but is part of it, what your genes are actually turned on during behavior? And we're just beginning to understand this because we've never been able to have the information to follow it. And this study looks at trauma. So, fascinating research. We will know more in the future.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Sobiski, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how can we help?
Well, a few years ago, I was diagnosed with some nerve damage as a result of a viral infection that I really didn't know I had because I wasn't that ill. And I pursued pharmaceutical over-the-counter stuff first because that's usually what I do. And probably maybe 2 weeks later, I went to an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and they did a hearing test, and they diagnosed me with nerve damage to my hearing in my right ear. And they tried to correct it with steroids, and that did not work. And so what the doctor told me was that I had waited too long for it to respond. And then that was that.
How long did you wait before you went and saw somebody when you had the hearing loss?
I want to say maybe 2 weeks because I was pursuing, you know, like Sudafed and those types of things.
Sure.
I didn't have a lot of symptoms. I had, again, I had what I would term a cold, and it was probably December of whatever year it was. And so I had some hearing loss in that ear, but not drastic.
Not excessive.
Correct. And it came on quickly. It wasn't over time.
Right, right. So they looked and they saw the hearing loss. And so your question is what?
You know, just because of the progression of alternative treatments, which I always look to, whether it's acupuncture or even more recently stem cell, I'm just wondering if there's something that can stimulate the nerve, which, according to what I was told, is really above my ear, you know, and in the, where there's also a possibility of tumor growth, which I do not have, to regenerate the nerve damage.
Well, part of the issue is the nerve goes through the auditory canal, which is a bone. I mean, it's a hole in the bone in our skull, and if the nerve swells up, the auditory nerve swells up, you can actually get some nerve dysfunction because the nerve was swollen. How long has it been since this occurred?
I think it was about 3 years ago.
About 3 years ago. If you have not gotten anything back in 3 years, the chances are not very good that you will get anything back. It's been a long period of time. And whether it was due to the virus or not, you know, they looked at it and, you know, and they saw through the testing that the nerve is just not responding. And obviously then it got stuck. I would certainly try alternative medicine, but Western medicine doesn't have anything for you to offer. Do you have a hearing aid?
I don't. Certainly can come to that. I don't have total loss yet, but I'm sure it kind of runs in our family as well.
So. Yeah. Do you have to keep on asking them to repeat questions when they're talking?
I turn my head to my good ear.
You turn your head to the good ear. Okay. Which makes a lot of sense. You turn it to the good ear. You've learned it from a behavioral point of view to do that, and that probably is the right way to do it because a hearing aid may or may not work depending on what the nerve damage is, but you actually. So do you mow the lawn?
I do mow the lawn.
Do you wear hearing protection?
I don't.
You have to wear hearing protection. Do you ever use a snowblower?
I don't have. It's a shovel.
Shovels don't make a lot of noise.
They're quiet.
You should protect yourself from loud noise. You should go.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of Amazon.com?
Yeah, you think?
You think, right, unless you're a Rumpelstiltskin. But there and at hardware stores, what you want to do is get hearing protection. For mowing the lawn, I recommend they look like big earphones. Don't use the small ones, and they cut it out completely. You can't hear a thing. They're big, bulky things. Use that 100% of the time because you want to protect your hearing. If you use personal hearing devices, if you're using an iPad, or rather an iPod, something else with hearing in the ears – turn it down. Do not turn the music up. If you end up going to a rock concert or something like that, plug your ears so you don't have it. When you are in an airplane, you should also bring hearing protection on the airplane and put it in your ears. What you want to do is protect your hearing, the bad ear, but especially the good ear, from getting worse.
Okay.
And that really is the most important thing you can do. You can delay the onset of presbyacoustis, I think that's how it's pronounced, which basically means old ears. And you can help delay that or keep that from happening, from protecting your hearing. So that is one thing you can get out of our wonderful radio conversation.
Wonderful. I appreciate all your insightful information every week.
Thank you, and
thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for that call at 800-462-7413. If you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. Now before the break, Zorba, buckle up. It's time to get yelled at again. This is Disagreeing with the Doc. The following email came to us from Anne in Knoxville, Tennessee. She is referring to a recent show where a listener called the show from a library, and Zorba was surprised how loud the library environment was. I was surprised, too, as I recall.
I think you were surprised. Yeah,
I was even more surprised than you.
Yeah.
Anyway, here's what Anne wrote. Dr. Pastor, on today's show, you had an unfortunate mention of librarians shushing people. Perhaps a really long time ago, in public and school libraries, shushing was a trait of librarians. Libraries have changed their priorities about what can happen there. They are now more vibrant spaces for collaboration and learning. And this includes taking off limits on food and noise. This shift and redesign has been going on in all types of libraries, school, public, and academic, for the last 20 years or more.
No, they're exactly right. When I've gone to libraries, like we have a beautiful library in Madison, I went to a gorgeous library in Halifax, Nova Scotia, when my wife and I were there, and I obviously go to libraries. We went to like a library in the UK, and you know what? It wasn't quiet, now that I think about it, but I carry with me the librarian that I had in school 50 years ago, where if you even went like, they would like come down on you like, you know, vultures saying, no, it's got to be totally quiet.
But now, in the libraries you've been in recently, were there people at tables sitting, concentrating?
No, they're kind of moving all over the place or looking at stuff.
Well,
on
see,
the web
that isn't the same kind of library.
There's a certain amount of noise, ambient noise, that still allows you to read. When you read, is it totally quiet in your house?
Yeah, sure.
Well, what about the TV? Is the TV on?
No.
No? What about the dog? Is the dog talking?
You know I don't have a dog, Zorba.
You are correct. Thank you for now telling me exactly the way libraries are. Libraries have become more collaborative places and meeting spots, and I think they're great. You know what they did? They changed with the times.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I have to do that, too.
You do, Tom. You do.
Do Zorba and I make mistakes now and then? Sure, we do. Let us know by posting on our Facebook page or by sending us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up, of course, and a delicious recipe all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again, if you have a question for Zorba, 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. 462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, carrot smoked salmon salad.
And avocado. Oh, gee, you actually had to throw it in because you're not an avocado lover. But now, if you have to choose between avocado and tofu, what would you choose?
Avocado.
Oh, I mean tofu. We have not had a tofu recipe in a long time. We need to have a tofu recipe. It has almost been years since we have had a tofu recipe or a tempeh recipe. We've got to get a couple of tofu recipes on this show. The show begs tofu.
Well, don't throw tofu in with this salad.
Okay. So, I love smoked salmon.
Smoked salmon's good.
And yeah. I love to get it. And I get it now at a variety of stores. It used to be when I was a kid extremely expensive. Now, it's not cheap, but it used to be much more expensive. So my mother would put lox and bagel, lox and smoked salmon and bagel, and she'd put it on, and we'd have a little bit, and then we'd smush it around to make a little square or go around the whole bagel because it was so expensive. Okay. Now, you're going to start out with three large carrots. You're going to peel them and julienne them. You make them into these kind of little strips. But you can do something even easier. You can buy a package of julienne carrots. And that's what I would recommend because it's a pain in the butt to julienne carrots. So one small package of julienne carrots. Mm-hmm. You buy them a little package.
Okay.
A half medium onion, thinly sliced.
A half medium onion, thinly sliced.
You know, you're eventually going to have salt and pepper in there, obviously.
Yep, S&P.
5 ounces of smoked salmon cut into small pieces.
5 ounces of smoked salmon cut into small pieces.
An avocado cut into one half inch dice. Now, one of the things about avocados that is really important is you want to choose the avocado that is firm. It's not overripe. You want to carefully take out that great big avocado pit in the middle of the avocado, which is a giant fruit. Carefully take the avocado out and put it in 1/2 inch dice, little squares.
I always do that. Avocado cut into 1/2 inch dice. Dice.
Your nose is getting longer, Tom.
Okay.
2 teaspoons of sesame oil.
2 little teas sesame oil.
And if you have some black sesame seeds for garnish, that actually will look good. You can buy those in a variety of stores. You can get them all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Black sesame seeds.
And then you're going to have salt and pepper.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
put the julienne carrots, sliced onion in a bowl, add the salt, let it sit for 30 minutes. And there's a reason behind this. The carrots will release liquid. In other words, some of the liquid comes out. It gets sucked out by the salt. You squeeze the carrots using a kneading motion, coax out as much of the liquid as you can off the carrots. You know, squeeze them, get all the liquid out, and you're going to be much better off. Okay, then grab a clump of the carrots. You squeeze as much out. Discard the liquid. Put the carrots in a separate bowl. Then add the salmon pieces, avocado, sesame oil and pepper, and if you've got some parsley, throw a bunch of parsley in, and then sprinkle the back sesame and toss everything to combine it. Mm-hmm. So what you'll have is you'll have something that really looks quite nice. You've got the orange of the carrot. You've got the green because if you've got some parsley, you want the green. You have the texture of the carrot versus the texture of the avocado. So it has a different taste, a different texture to it. You've got smoked salmon that has another total taste to it. If you've got some freshly ground black pepper and salt, that's good. If you have sesame seeds on the top of it, that would be good. And if you want to add something with bite, put 2 things on the table. Number one, put some Tabasco sauce so people can have that. And number two, cut up a lime and put that on top of it because a lime, little lime squeezed on the top of it for those people who like it will add a little bit of flavor and bite to this. And you've got a really interesting tasting, quick salad that looks quite nice on a table when you're serving, when you have the guys over for lunch.
Yeah, do you have that as a main course or just as a side?
No, this is something, it depends. If you're on a diet and you're trying to lose weight, you might have this as a main course and it would be quite tasty, and it'd be quite nutritious. I mean, it's got calories. It's got 225 calories, not very much. A quarter of it is from fat, but it's avocado fat, which is an okay fat to have. Yeah, you would have this as a light lunch.
Got it. And for those who would like a copy of this recipe?
Well, there are many ways to get it, but actually there's only one way that works. And the one way that works is to go to ZorbaPastor.org directly or through Facebook. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can see Tom on our Facebook page, and that will make you smile.
So what are those ways that don't work?
We call that the U.S. Post Office. Do not send us a self-addressed stamped envelope. Forget it.
800-462-7413.
Back in the day.
1-800-462-7413.
You know, you can't say the check is in the mail anymore either.
Let's get back to the phones. A listener joins in now from Platteville, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi there. I've been dealing with obesity for the last few years now, and I have decided to go on a very low-carb diet just to kind of fight off insulin resistance and prediabetes. And I'm wondering what the main risks are of going on an extremely low-carb diet.
Well, first of all, have you done it, and have you lost weight?
Yes, I'm down 25 pounds right now
in
2 months.
Good work. Well, that's a good question. I don't know if there's any there, to my knowledge, there's no good study that shows that there is risk associated with a low-carb diet. I don't think there are any good studies. Now, I want to go back to the studies that even we've said for years. You know, for years we said, stay away from fats. Fats are bad for you. And you think about all the junk that we've said that's wrong, like have margarine instead of butter. Well, the trans fats will get you if the butter doesn't. That was wrong. And Snackwells, if you remember correctly, many years ago, Snackwells, the idea is there's no fat in a cookie. And it turns out it's all carb, and that wasn't good. And then you look at the carbs that we eat in sugary drinks. So the reality is if you're losing weight and it's working for you, I don't see any risk for it at all. The problem is with any diet at all is the 2-year success rate is about 5% or 10%. So the question is, how do you get to that success? You know, you want to be the 1 out of 10, the 1 out of 20, the 1 out of 5 maybe, but it's really 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 20 who still has the weight off 2 years down the line. And the answer is, once people go off the diet, the weight goes back on because they're eating too many calories, I mean, and because of the type of food. So you have to be very, very careful when you reintroduce other foods if you're going to do it. Most people do because they want them. They go, I want some to have some carbohydrates. I like carbohydrates. Be careful. You're not doing yourself harm going off. Yo-yo diets are not bad for the body. There's no proof that they're bad for the body. But they're bad for the mind because we go, I'm losing weight, I'm gaining weight. So just be careful when you go off this diet, if you are. By the way, this diet is an ancient diet. In the 1890s, if you were in the UK, if you were fat, it was actually a sign of wealth because there were very few calories. If you were thin, it was a sign you didn't have a lot of you didn't have a lot of money. But fat people wanted to lose weight in the UK. So they had the bacon mutton diet where they would eat nothing but mutton and bacon. And so I just want to tell you, these diets come and go.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Yeah, we appreciate that call at 800-462-7413.
You're laughing. You want to go on the mutton bacon diet, huh?
Happily, that's not something I need to do. 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. Mel Zorba, a listener, is with us in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, my 20-year-old son was involved in a minor car crash almost 2 weeks ago. He suffered a cut on his forehead and around his eyes and nose. So we went to the ER just to rule out anything more severe than a concussion.
Sure. He had a seatbelt on or did not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
he did.
Good.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They did a CAT scan of his head, ruled out any breaks or bleeds. However, they found a calcification over the right frontal lobe.
Mm-hmm.
Then they said it may present an osteoma or small meningioma.
Mm-hmm.
And the ER doctor said, you're here for the head injury, for the bang, so follow up with your doctor on this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, gosh darn it, I Googled things and I shouldn't have and got all panicky and worried.
Well, I think you should Google things, and you're the mom. You should be panicking away. That's your job. Your job is to panic and then figure out what to do. That's what mothers do. Dads do it too, by the way, not just moms. So.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. He does have an appointment for a regular PCP. Mm-hmm. He said we'd have to see his regular doctor before a referral to a neurologist or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But while we're waiting for that appointment, do I really need to worry? I don't know what this.
Sure. Well, first of all, this is an interesting thing. There are findings that we find when we're looking for other things. So on the CT scan, they saw a calcification, and the radiologist looked and said it might be from this, might be something called a meningioma, from which they don't necessarily. They may do something about it, or they may not. But the next step often is to actually get an MRI scan, which will really evaluate this even more. You want to see, is this something, what did this calcification mean? A lot of times we pick things up that don't have meaning. I'll give you a perfect example. You get a mammogram as a woman, and you may say, we see some calcium on the mammogram. We want to make sure that there's not cancer. And so we do further mammograms, further testing. We may do an ultrasound. We might do an MRI. Some of them turn out to be cancer, but many of them don't. They just turn out to be calcifications. Some of the calcifications we watch for years and nothing ever happens. So calcium in the spot that they saw doesn't mean that there's something wrong, but it does mean that you want to do the further evaluation. So I don't think panicking, I think being concerned is the proper thing, but you're going to go there. He definitely needs an MRI. There's no doubt about it. He needs an MRI to evaluate it. And then if the MRI is abnormal, then he needs to see somebody who knows how to deal with that, either A, a neurologist, or B, a neurosurgeon. Some things are just watched and nothing happens because nothing actually occurred. And other things actually need surgery. The good news is if it's something bad, it was picked up.
Okay.
That's the good news about the injury, right? If it's something bad. The bad news is you may be anxious about it, but you're as the mom, you're making sure he takes care of it. Your son is, how old did you say? It was 20. You're taking care of it. You're doing it on a timely basis. Things are going to work out. We've got good ways of figuring this out. Modern medicine and technology is incredible because we can find out so much more now than we could even 5 and 10 years ago.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. I hope that helps you sort of put a perspective on it.
It does. Absolutely. Yes. So, thank you.
Take care. Good luck. Let us know what happens, please.
I certainly will.
Before the break now, Zorba, let's check in again with your favorite backseat drivers, the Grammar Police. But wait, Brad. Don't play the theme song yet. Actually, Zorba, this message is from the small but honorable team of agents who are deeply committed to restoring order and clarity regarding the language we use on our show.
I'm just listening with bated breath.
So get ready. The following dispatch comes from the hallowed halls of the Grammar Police. On a recent show, you were smacked down by our lovely grammar police.
That's right.
For using the word handfuls.
Oh, that's right.
During a recipe segment. Well, here's what an agent who calls himself Mike had to say about that particular citation. Dear Dr. Pastor, I disagree with your most recent critic.
Oh.
Handful, hands full, and handfuls, according to Merriam-Webster, all three are correct.
Oh, great.
Dictionary.com only lists handfuls as the plural, so I suspect that is the most common. Keep on doing things the way that feels right and ignore the critics.
I will take Merriam-Webster over Dictionary.com any day of the week. Thank you. Wait a minute.
Okay, I'll
thank
join
you.
That. Yeah.
Thank you, Grammar Police. Police.
Are you brave enough to rescue Zorba from the absolute grip of the Grammar Police?
Oh my God! Save me! Save me!
Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More calls coming up, and another topic to talk about will be Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba, too. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. The number, if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, salt.
Salt. So salt, big issue. It's been an issue all along. I mean, and the question is salt in heart failure. Now, heart failure affects almost 6 million Americans, lots of Americans, and it's the inability for the heart to keep up with its metabolic needs. And there are a bunch of reasons that you get heart failure. Chronic high blood pressure that's not treated can do it. Previous heart attacks, anything that really injures the heart makes the heart muscle kind of not work as well as it should. And the treatment is often medical treatment with diuretics, for example. Hypertensive drugs called ACE inhibitors are commonly used in heart failure and a bunch of other things. But what's often also recommended is a low-salt diet. But we're talking not about the typical low-salt diet, but a super low-salt diet. Now, my old partner, Dr. Dukeshine, who has since passed away, he was on a diet where he put in no salt, which is basically potassium in his diet, and he hated it. And for because he had had heart failure, lived for a long time, and Margaret, his wife, was like she was like the food Nazi and made sure that he never had any salt. That's what he said. She was very Germanic about the whole thing. That was her comment about the whole situation with salt. But anyway, it turns out the evidence for the super low salt diet is lacking. Now, we're not talking about the reduction in salt because we eat too much salt, but putting patients on the super low salt diet is lacking. In this particular study, it was a study of studies. They looked at patients. They looked at them over time. They looked at heart failure, death from heart failure, and they could not find evidence that a super low salt diet was actually useful. So we're not talking about a reduction in salt that we should all do, but making it a super low salt diet. I think this is important to get out there.
Well, how do we know what the right amount of salt is?
Well, first of all, the answer is if you can season your food with something other than salt, you're better off. And the reason is salt is in so many foods. Certainly it's in prepared foods. Certainly it's in soups unless you buy low-salt soups. And we've habituated ourselves to eating lots of salt. But this particular study looked at the super low-salt diet and said that we basically are giving advice that is not scientifically based.
Well, how did the study work?
Well, this was a study, different studies. In other words, they looked at the analysis of people on super low-salt diets. They found about 500 people actually followed the super low-salt diet for the entire time and found that it didn't make a difference in terms of their ability to sort of live. I think this is important because we often go to the extremes in medicine and we give advice that we ourselves could not follow. In other words, we might say, go on a super low-salt diet, but we would find it tasteless and we could never follow the diet. Loosen up on the salt a bit, and you'll be just as healthy.
1-800-462-7413 is our number if you have a question for Zorba. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Galena, Illinois. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Zorba and Tom.
Yeah, what's up?
Well, my wife's been going to a storefront clinic for hip pain, and the therapy they use, she's been going two or three times a week. The therapy they use is called low-intensity laser therapy. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to be based on a Chinese study, acupuncture. But this is laserless acupuncture.
So wait a minute. I want to get it straight. It's laser therapy that doesn't use a laser?
No, it uses a laser instead instead of needles, those pesky needles.
How much for each treatment?
$45.
And how many treatments has she had?
Two or three a week for several weeks.
So it's $150, $200 a week for Sarah. So she spent like $500 to $1,000 on it.
Yep.
Okay.
They also suggest a stretching exercise. My feeling is that stretching exercise probably relieves some pain.
Right.
But the laser therapy is snake oil.
Yes. Laser therapy is undoubtedly snake oil, and the stretching exercises that she's giving is actually improving her pain and discomfort. You know something? You could be a detective. Absolutely. You've discovered the fact that it's a good example of, well, first of all, I'm not against alternative and complementary medicine. I think it's great.
I'm not either.
2 to 3 times a week. $500 to $1,000. I'm against people pilfering my wallet under a quasi-scientific thing. Oh, this has been working, and it's a Chinese study, and you know, Western doctors don't understand this. And please come back next. Please come back next. Please come back next. And all of a sudden, you have money that's come out of your pocket, and the stretching exercise after the treatment is probably doing it. There's no evidence at all that laser therapy is doing much. Now, acupuncture, ancient Chinese, does work for some people. But they use needles, and they're trained to put the needles in the right, in the right energy zones. And essentially,
right.
That therapy is, you know, it is scientifically based in many ways. But I think the laser stuff is just quackery. What's
I
your wife
too.
Say? Have you talked to her about it? I'm sure you have.
Yes, she is feeling better, so she's going ahead with it. I think, though, that I can probably convince her.
Well, I think you ought to convince her that you ought to do the stretching exercises, see what happens over the next month, and just stop the laser. I mean, the reality is,
I agree.
You know, let's go on with stretching exercises and see what you do. You know, if that's not good, go to a trainer or a physical therapist. Well, a PT would know exactly what exercise to do and see how that works. Because then you can say, well, the laser kick-started the whole thing. Although, I think it's probably not the laser that did that. So, good luck. I never enter into these type of family discussions.
I try to hold off.
Yes. Yes. How long have you guys been married?
21 years.
That's right. That's what you learn after 2 decades of marriage. What to enter into and what not to.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Zorba.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
I love the humor that you and Tom provide and the sound medical advice.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you. Very
thank
nice.
You. Very, it's a very nice
we,
compliment.
We appreciate
thank
the call, too, at 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413.
Wasn't that nice?
Yes.
Very nice.
Yes. Now, Zorba, time again to slog through the murky waters of medical quackery. Let's light up another segment of Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quack it up with Dr. Zorba.
Okay, Zorba, you're a doctor, right?
Yeah, I hope so. That's right. I have been a doctor.
Yeah, I know that. I know that. Mm-hmm. I've been looking across the table here at a doctor for a lot of years. Okay, as a doctor, what brand of cigarettes do you officially endorse?
Right, that's exactly it. There are a couple of interesting things. Doctors were endorsing cigarettes, and Camels were the big one. I often showed, when I give lectures, I used to have slides. Now I've got it, of course, on PowerPoint. You know, a slide that showed more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. And they always show a picture of a doctor, undoubtedly it wasn't a doctor.
Oh, with a white
with his
white
coat and a stethoscope. Yeah. You know, 9 out of 10 surgeons smoke Camels. The American Tobacco Company campaign advertised Lucky Strikes as being less irritating, and physicians were cropping up in ads promoting Lucky Strike in the 30s. Philip Morris, kind of a newcomer to the game, successful advertising came reporting that a group of doctors founded cigarettes to improve or completely clear irritation of the nose and throat from smoking. In other words, if you have an irritation, smoking. But wait a second, let's go one step further with the tobacco lobby. Back in the day, they had tobacco toothpaste. So you could.
I don't remember that.
You could actually brush your teeth
with tobacco.
With toothpaste that had tobacco in it. So you could actually have tobacco toothpaste. So when it comes to tobacco, folks, doctors and dentists, for that matter, may have recommended tobacco toothpaste. We're clearly in the pockets of the tobacco industry promoting their product.
Yeah. What made those commercials go away? There wasn't any law or anything.
There was a law. First of all, the television commercials went away because there was a law passed. And the big issue was who's going to advertise on TV, because half the advertisements on television at the time were tobacco. Remember the jingles? Winston tastes good like a
cigarette should.
Cigarette should. Yeah, Winston gives you real flavor, real rich tobacco. Winston tastes good like a cigarette. I mean, I can do all the commercials for that. Think I can do a commercial for Colgate Palmolive toothpaste? No way. So they basically, money was in the game, tobacco industry. And the fact is, that's why doctors were recommending smoking. But the real question today is, where's the money in the game for what physicians now recommend?
Did you have ashtrays in your office?
Of course we had ashtrays. We had ashtrays until 1987. We had ashtrays. And in our old office, when I was with Dr. Kellogg at Dukeshine, Sandy in the basement did all of the insurance. Everyone had to go down and talk to Sandy. She was a chain smoker next to Gene, who did the books, who didn't smoke at all. I mean, in this day and age, obviously Sandy would have gone outside, but not back in the 80s.
Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this segment? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now, Zorba, back to the phones we go at 800-462-7413. And now we welcome a listener in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, how are you all?
Fine. How can we help?
I have problems with watery eyes, and I've had them for years. I went on a whole food diet, kind of a vegan diet, for 30 days, and they really cleared up.
Wow.
But I would assume that would be the cause of the diet.
Mm-hmm.
Once I went off of it.
I mean, if they cleared up, that would be one way that you might treat it. So maybe there was a dietary issue if you noticed it. Sure. Do you want to stay on that diet?
Well, I would like to, but it's kind of hard to.
Yes, especially living in Oklahoma, where beef is king. Cattleman's Restaurant, when I went into in Oklahoma City, was like, you know, the restaurant of choice. So
that's right. I'm a vegetarian, actually. I went on this kind of vegan diet, but I'm an exception in Oklahoma, I can tell you that.
Okay, there are a few things that you can do. So first of all, sometimes the problem is in the gutter. You know, what happens is we have water that goes down from the eye into the nose, okay? And because if we cry and our nose is stuffed, that's because all the tears are going sort of down this drain, if you will. Sometimes the drain is clogged, has to be opened up. Sometimes they actually put things into the drain to make the drain bigger, a little artificial drain in the eye. It's a surgical procedure, and they do it because some people have watery eyes and they look like they're crying all the time. Sometimes they actually do reconstructive surgery to actually make a better gutter. These are the more extreme ways that we look at if everything else fails. One of the things you can often do for watery eyes is incredibly simple. It is a warm, moist compress. And you do it 2 to 3 times a day. You take a washcloth, you put it in warm water, and you put it over your eye. Or you go to Amazon.com or your local drugstore, and you get these wonderful nifty compresses that you put in a microwave. They warm up, and you put that over your eye 3 or 4 times a day. You can also put it in warm water. It'll warm it up. And once again, it puts warmth into the eye, which opens up the ducts and often will decrease the amount of tears and will allow the tears to flow. So a warm compress, either through one of these things you put in the microwave or warm moist compress, which is even better, may do it. The third thing you may look at is a decongestant eye drop. And you go to the pharmacist, and over-the-counter ones used to be called Nafcone or Vasocone, and they're decongestant eye drops, which can also dry up the eye just a little bit, and that can make a difference too. So those are different things. I would do the compress first because it's non-chemical, and then I would do the compress plus the drops second. You know, I'd put the drops in and do the compress in the morning when I got up, maybe at noon, maybe three or four times a day. I'd put it before night. And I would try that first. Chances are that'll work. That works like easily 90% of the time.
Great. Well, thank you so very much.
You are most welcome. And enjoy Oklahoma. I love it. I went to Oklahoma City a couple times. It's a great place.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-462-7413 is our number. 1-800-462-7413. Now, before we head out, Zorba, let's crack open the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and share a listener email. This one came to us from a listener, Rick, in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi, guys. First, I love the show. You guys are wonderful. You are the Car Talk of Medical Radio. You're Doc and I'm
Click and Clack.
Dope.
You're Doc and Dope.
He continues, I'm 37 and I recently discovered I am low on my vitamin D levels, so I got a boost through a prescription. Now, I would like to get more vitamin D, but there's one problem. I'm a vampire. I've always been a night owl and worked third shift. So he says, now I'm going to force myself to go outside and sit in the sun for a little while.
How about in the middle of winter in Wisconsin? Let's see how well you do here in January.
It's a summer thing. I was wondering how much skin needs to be exposed. I don't plan on going the full Monty or anything, but I'm going to sit out there. I want to make sure I'm getting the benefit. Also, if Tom ever writes a book, it should be titled from a quote he said on a recent show, "They don't put tuna in TV dinners," by Tom Clark.
They don't put tuna in TV dinners. By Tom Clark. A biography. I like it. I think the title would go, Tom. You got to write it.
Yeah, I got to write it. So what's your advice for our listener?
Well, let me put it this way. I once calculated how much sun you'd have to get January 15th if you wanted to get enough vitamin D through the sun. Mm-hmm. And you'd actually have to bare the top part of your body for 4 hours in the sun in Wisconsin to actually be able to generate the – we get vitamin D from other sources. But clearly, if you're vitamin D deficient, you know the best amount of sun you can get. Go out in the sun and swallow your vitamin D capsule. And that basically is the way to do it. But getting it through the sun, if you're vitamin D deficient, and if that's a current issue – the capsule is what works.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And of course, as Tom said, Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more information on Dr. Zorba Pastor and to listen to current or past episodes, go to ZorbaPastor.org. There you can subscribe to the weekly podcast, and you will find the show archive, Zorba's favorite recipes, his healthy living articles, and other helpful tips heard on the show. That's ZorbaPastor.org.